Faith in the Fire, from Selected Psalms. This is an exposition of Psalm 44. This message by Pastor Rod Harris was delivered at Trinity Baptist Church on Wednesday evening, August the 22nd, 2018.
Do you ever have times when you struggle to believe, struggle to hold on in your faith? Times when you just look at your circumstances and you wonder, Lord, where are you? Are you still here? Are you aware of what I'm going through? Are you aware of the struggle that I find myself in? I mean, there just are times that even as the people of God, we have our doubts. And I know that James warns us that the person who doubts is like the one who's tossed about by every wind that comes along. So I'm not talking about crippling doubt, the kind of doubt that questions whether God exists or questions whether God is good or whether God has power. But I mean, do you ever struggle with making sense of God's sovereign, God's in control, and this thing is happening, and I don't see how the two line up? I don't see, if God works all things together for my good and His glory, I don't see how that happens given this circumstance. You ever struggle to believe? Sometimes we get the mistaken idea that doubt and struggle is not normal in the Christian life. That's something that happens to people who are weak in their faith. But I want to suggest that that's not true at all. Godly, faithful, believing folks struggle. After all, faith is the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things you can't see. Faith, by its very nature, is a struggle. The only time you don't struggle is when you have it in your hand. But as long as you're believing, there will be some level of struggle. Not saying again that you would doubt God's existence, but maybe you wonder if He's paying attention. You don't doubt God's power, but you wonder if He's temporarily out of order. You don't doubt God's love, but maybe you wonder at some point if you've become unlovable. What do you do when things are rough? What do you do when the circumstance of your life causes you to struggle, causes you to doubt? Well, let's turn to Psalm 44 and get some help. Psalm 44, and we'll walk through the whole thing. It is another of the Psalms of the sons of Korah. We don't know which one. And we don't know the specific circumstance. We're not told this was written when such and such happened. We're left to try to figure out or piece together by what we read in the psalm. When we do that, we do know some things about the situation. We don't know specifically what it is, but what we do know is Israel finds themselves the object of scorn. Their enemies are surrounding them and scoffing and laughing. They're being mocked. They're covered with shame. They feel disgraced and they feel abandoned. One of the things I appreciate about the Psalms is that it runs the whole gamut of emotions. And there are times when it's just exuberant. There are times when it's mournful. And there's times when it's both exuberant and mournful within the same psalm. And I find that encouraging because it mirrors the kind of thing I experience in my life. There are times when I'm just overwhelmed with the greatness and the glory and the goodness of God. There are other times when I just struggle. And so I find the psalms helpful because they're real, written by real people in real circumstances. Let's look together beginning in verse 1 of Psalm 44. O God, we have heard with our ears. Our fathers have told us what deeds you performed in their days, in the days of old. You with your own hand drove out the nation, but them you planted. You afflicted the peoples, but them you set free. For not by their own sword did they win the land, nor did their own arm save them, but your right hand and your right arm, and the light of your face, for you delighted in them. You are my king, O God. Ordain salvation for Jacob. Through you we push down our foes. Through your name we tread down those who rise up against us. For not in my bow do I trust, nor can my sword save me. But you have saved us from our foes, and have put to shame those who hate us. In God we have boasted continually, and we give thanks to your name forever. And then you'll find that notation out to the side, Selah, rest, stop, think, reflect. So as we walk through this psalm, it's broken down into three parts. And the first part here in the first eight verses, they look back at God's past deliverance, at God's goodness and his grace to them as a people in the past. And then verse 9 through verse 22, the psalmist deals with the current dilemma that he finds himself in. And then finally, in verses 23 through 26, he confidently looks to the future. If you've ever struggled, this psalm is for you. If you've ever felt that you've been abandoned, you'll find some comfort here. If you've ever been confused, I think you'll find some hope. In this first section, we discover that the righteous glory in God's gracious work on behalf of his people. The righteous, those who are the people of faith, those who've committed themselves to God, those who are in relationship with Christ, we look and we're thankful for God's faithfulness and the way he's dealt with his people. That we have this record that we are told by Paul in the New Testament that the Old Testament has given us for our instruction. That we have all these examples of what God has done in the past, and therefore we have every reason to believe that he continues to do the same things in our day because he is the same yesterday, today, and forever. So we're not New Testament Christians, we're Bible Christians. We have an Old and a New Testament, and both are a word for us, and both are a revelation of God, and Christ is the focus from Genesis all the way through Revelation. And so the first thing we need to note about how do we get through those tough and difficult times is, as the people of God, we need to look back and be thankful and recognize the gracious work of God on behalf of his people. Israel has a great history, and it's been handed down orally through generations. That's why the psalmist begins by saying, "O God, we have heard with our ears. Our fathers have told us about the days in the past, about the days in the past, in their distant past, and what you did." And the phrase, "we have heard with our ears," implies that we heard with great joy. So it's a matter that they were thrilled to hear these stories. You remember, Deuteronomy says that the parents have a responsibility to tell the stories to their children. You'll remember that as they were in the wilderness wandering, something would happen, some great momentous thing happened in the history of God's people, and God would tell them, "You need to grab some rocks and pile them up over there." Which seems like a really strange thing. Why are you piling rocks? Well, we're told, in generations to come, when you pass this way and your children say, "What are those rocks over there?" That's your opportunity to explain what God has done. That's your opportunity to tell the story of God's gracious work, to be an encouragement to those generations that follow. We have heard with our ear. Our fathers have told us what you did in their days, in days long ago. The stories were a delight. They were grateful to hear the account because it was useful in building faith and building courage within them. He goes on to recount the deliverance from Egypt and the Passover, which was that pivotal event in the Old Testament times. And he recounts the events of the conquest of Canaan. And he's quick to say it was the hand of God that delivered them. They didn't bring themselves out of Egypt, and they didn't conquer the land of Canaan. It was the hand of God. It was God's right hand. It was God's right arm. It was God working on their behalf. In verse 4, he speaks of a more recent victory. You are my king, O God, ordained salvation for Jacob. Through you, we pushed down our foes. So now it's not just long ago, but it's in their recent past as they remember God graciously working. Through you, we pushed back our enemies. You gave us victory over our enemies. In God, we make our boast. You know, if we stop at verse 8, we're thinking, boy, this is one of those celebratory psalms. It sounds good. In fact, as I read those first 8 verses, I come to the end of verse 8 and I say, it's all good. I mean, these are all very positive, wonderful things. And we pause and we reflect, and then we pick up verse 9. We note it's very different. Something changes. That's led many scholars and commentators to suggest that this isn't a single psalm, but somehow they got thrown together. That the first 8 verses don't belong with the rest of it. But I think if you look at it, it does belong. It's a very natural progression. Because the issue is a man of God, a servant of God, a person of faith, struggling to make sense of the circumstance they're in. Look beginning at verse 9 as we come to the second thing, the righteous struggle to make sense of God's sovereign control in times of great trouble. When times are hard, when times are difficult, when things aren't going the way we'd like for them to go, when things are confusing, there is genuine struggle. We have boasted continually, and we give thanks to your name forever, verse 8. Verse 9, but you have rejected us and disgraced us and have gone out and have not gone out with our armies. That'll give you whiplash. I mean, that's such a dramatic change. We praise you continually, but now you've disgraced us. You've left us. You don't support us anymore. You don't go out with our armies. You've made us turn back from the foe. And those who hate us have gotten spoil. You've made us like sheep for slaughter and have scattered us among the nations. You have sold your people for a trifle, demanding no high price for them. You've made us the taunt of our neighbors, the derision and scorn of those around us. You have made us a byword among the nations, a laughingstock among the peoples. All day long, my disgrace is before me. And shame has covered my face at the sound of the taunter and the reviler, at the sight of the enemy and the avenger. All this has come upon us, though we have not forgotten you, and we have not been false to your covenant. Our heart has not turned back, nor have our steps departed from your way, yet you have broken us in the place of the jackals and covered us with the shadow of death. If we had forgotten the name of our God or spread out our hands to a foreign God, would not God discover this? For he knows the secrets of our hearts. Yet for your sake, we are killed all the day long. We are regarded as sheep to be slaughtered. I understand the sentiment that says, I don't know that these go together, because it is a radical change. There is a huge departure to go from saying, we praise you continually because things are so good and you've been so faithful, to then you've disgraced us, you've sold us out, you have led us like sheep to the slaughter, you've allowed us to be scattered, you've sold us for next to nothing. And disgrace is continually before me. This is the cry of a man who's hurting, a man who is confused, a man who is struggling to understand in the midst of life's complications. You've rejected us and humbled us. You no longer go out with our armies. Just as quick as the psalmist was to give God credit for their victory, he now gives God credit for their defeat. And what I want you to see in that is, despite his confusion, despite his struggle to understand and make sense, he is still affirming that God is sovereign over everything. That he has not lost faith. To doubt, to struggle to understand, to struggle to make sense, is not abandoning faith. It is the working out of faith. It is the seeking to make sense. It is the seeking to understand how all this comes together. How does this fit together? How is God sovereign? How does God provide? How is God faithful to us and yet allow this to happen? I'm trying to make sense. I'm trying to understand, because in my pain, in my heartache, I don't understand it. It doesn't fit together. It isn't right. Now, as I read through this whole section 9 down through 22, I don't read any bitterness in it at all. If there was bitterness, he wouldn't end where he does in verse 26, of being confident of God's grace and God's goodness. This is the heart of faith trying to understand. There is that phrase in verse 9, but now. We hear that a lot in Scripture. We hear a lot in the New Testament, and it's usually something was bad, but now it's a whole lot better. We get that sense of it in the New Testament in Romans. In Romans 3, Paul has been describing the hopeless condition of the human race and its sin. And then he says, but now a righteousness from God, apart from the law, has been made known. So there he's moving from bad to good. He's saying, this is where we were. This is the struggle. But now God has shown it. God has revealed. God has made known. And things are so great. Here in Psalm 44, it's going the other way. Things were great, but now it's not so good. Now it's hard. It's difficult. We move from a glorious past to a tragic present. The psalmist is struggling for an answer. Well, maybe God's looking the other way, or he's asleep. Well, that would work for a pagan, but not for the people of God, because God doesn't slumber, neither does he sleep. God is not unattentive to his people and their needs. He's not indifferent. The psalmist is convinced that their defeat is no accident. He's convinced that the hand of God is in it. Just read down through that section and see how often he says, you have, you have, you have. He's saying God's in control. He doesn't understand why this is happening, but he doesn't seem to have any concern or any question at all but that God is in control. Disaster is only puzzling when God's in control and he loves his people. When we have those two things firmly in mind, firmly in our heart as the truth revealed in Scripture, only then are we puzzled by the hard and difficult things. That doesn't make sense. Why is he allowing it? And so I think that's what is happening in this section. The psalmist is struggling. Well, maybe God's looking the other way. No, that can't be. Maybe this defeat is not as bad as it appears. Maybe in his pain and his heartache, he's blowing it out of proportion. He's exaggerating, but I don't think that's it either, because of the language he uses. Verse 11, he says, you've made us like sheep for the slaughter. You've scattered us. 13 through 16, we're a reproach to our neighbors. We're covered with shame and covered with disgrace. So I don't think he's exaggerating. I think he's being honest. Being honest about some very hard and troublesome times. How is it the wicked are prospering? How is it the wicked are doing so well? How is it that the righteous are suffering in this manner? Well, maybe they're to blame. Maybe they've sinned and they just won't admit it. Well, that's not it either, because of what we read in 17 and 18. All this has come upon us, though we have not forgotten you. We have not been false to your covenant. Our heart has not turned back, nor have our steps departed from your way. Now, He's not claiming to be completely innocent and sinless in all this, but what he is saying is, we haven't done anything to deserve this particular thing that has come upon us. Again, he's not claiming sinlessness. What he's saying is, we haven't been guilty of something that would naturally cause God to treat us in this way, that would cause God to come against us in such judgment. In fact, it seems that as they argue for their innocence, that the scripture affirms that, because this section is quoted in Romans 8, 35 through 37. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness or danger or sword? As it is written, for your sake we are being killed all the day long. We are regarded as sheep to the slaughter. No, in all these things we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. Paul in Romans pulls in this passage in the context that they're suffering innocently. Faithful believers throughout the history of the church have served God, and yet they've been made to face death all day long. How do we explain that? I don't know. It's just the reality of life in a fallen world. Why did it happen? I don't know. No explanation is given. So in struggling to make sense of tragic times and searching for assurance, we sometimes don't have an answer. Wish we did. And we want one. And as a pastor, I want to give an answer. When someone comes to me and struggling with some area, they're struggling with things that are happening in their life and wondering, why has this happened to our family? Why did I lose that job? Why has this happened? Why did my son leave? Why did my child get involved in all those kinds of questions? I want to answer, and sometimes there's not an answer that we can see. Now, I can say ultimately, well, God willed it for whatever purpose. But while that is true, I don't want to hear that in the midst of my struggle. I don't want to hear that in my pain. There is such a thing as truth, and there's such a thing as a timely truth. This isn't the time to press that. When I am with a family who's just suffered a horrific loss that came out of nowhere, it's not a time for patting them on the shoulder and say, well, God wanted this to happen and you just need to accept it. It's a time to put my arm around them and cry with them. There are times when we do not have an answer. So what do we do? What do we do when we don't have an answer? We continue to believe. We continue to trust. That's the life of faith. And yes, sometimes it's a struggle. And sometimes it's a horrific struggle. Sometimes it's the kind of struggle that just beats us down. What do we do when there isn't an answer? What do we do when we can't find a way out? We continue to believe and we continue to trust on the basis that God has shown himself worthy of our trust. That God has shown himself as sovereign, as loving, as caring, as gracious, and he's made certain promises to us that though I don't understand and though I don't see how he's going to get me there from where I am here, I'm going to trust him. Because ultimately I know and I believe with every fiber of my being, from as deep down inside as I can find it, he spoke and the whole world came into being. And the whole world is moving according to his schedule and according to his plan. So when I can't see the answer, when I can't find the connection, I just have to trust God. I just have to believe. Not blindly. I'm not talking about a leap in the dark. I'm talking about trusting someone who has proven himself worthy of my trust. Someone who's already traveled the road. Someone who's already been there. Someone who already knows how it ends. Third, verse 23 down through the end of the psalm. The righteous look confidently to the future in spite of God's apparent lack of concern. Right after saying, "Yet for your sake we are killed all the day long, we're regarded as sheep to be slaughtered," the psalmist says, "Awake! Why are you sleeping, O Lord? Rouse yourself. Do not reject us forever. Why do you hide your face? Why do you forget our affliction and oppression? For our soul is bowed down to the dust. Our belly clings to the ground. Rise up. Come to our help. Redeem us for the sake of your steadfast love." So what is the psalmist saying? He's saying it's hard. It's difficult. And I want you to do something. Wake up. Rise up. Move on my behalf. Move on our behalf. Deliver us. Rescue us. But don't lose sight of the very last line. For the sake of your steadfast love. The psalmist, though he struggles to understand, the psalmist, though it doesn't make any sense to him, though he doesn't see how in the world this connects up, he is confident of the steadfast love of God. He's confident of God's covenant with his people. That's what steadfast love is about. That's covenant love. That is love based on the promises that God has made. So even though he doesn't understand, even though it is a struggle, and even though he says, "Wake up and do something," he's confident because he believes that God is a covenant God who is always faithful to his promise, and ultimately he comes to rest in the covenant-keeping love of God. Struggle is inevitable in this life. Faith doesn't eliminate it. Faith believes in spite of the struggle. Faith holds on. Not because it's unreasonable, but because God has proven himself faithful. So in spite of the struggle, in spite of doubt and confusion, the righteous tenaciously cling to God by faith.
You've been listening to the TBC Tulsa podcast, which features the preaching ministry of Pastor Rod Harris at Trinity Baptist Church in Tulsa, Oklahoma, located at the corner of 41st and Union. To learn more about the ministries at Trinity Baptist Church, visit us on the web at www.tbctulsa.org.